All right, so I'm going to be continuing this morning in the book of Genesis, if you want to turn there. I can't really give you a specific chapter because we're going to be covering a lot of ground, and I'd like to start with doing a little bit of a review of what we've covered so far in the book of Genesis. So we saw in chapter 1, God created the world. He took something that was formless and void, covered in darkness and covered in deep waters, and he, from that, made something that was good, something that was good for life. And he placed the first man and the first woman there, and he gave them abundantly everything that they could possibly want. He gave them all these rivers of water. He gave them all these trees and this garden for them. And yet, despite all of God's provision, the Adam and Eve became fixated on this one thing that God said that they should not have. This one test that God placed for them in the Garden of Eden, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And the serpent took God's very permissive and abundant provision for them, and he made it seem very restrictive instead of very free. And he took God's commands, he made it seem restrictive, and he got Adam and Eve to distrust God, and they went against God's warning and took from the tree, and as a result of that, we saw the devastating consequences, especially in the next generation, in their children, when Cain killed his brother Abel. And we saw the three curses that God placed on Adam and Eve after they disobeyed him, mirroring the three blessings that started off the creation. Now there's three curses, but in the middle of those curses, there was some hope. God promised that just like the sin originally entered the world as a result of Eve, also through Eve, specifically through her descendants, or maybe one of her descendants, that there would finally be someone who would strike the serpent in the head, even as he gets struck in the heel. But this process is going to be a painful process, just like the process of childbirth is painful. The process of producing this promised descendants would be a long, painful, and drawn-out process. And we may have hoped in the first generation after Adam and Eve that they would be better than their parents and finally defeat the serpent, but instead we find that Cain gives into temptation and kills his brother as a result of jealousy. And then we see this family continue to develop. We see the problem is definitely not that they're not intelligent. We see them doing things like metallurgy, very complicated science. The problem isn't that they're not artistic. We see them producing musical instruments. We see all of these things. They're all united. They all have the same language. They are all one big family. They have everything going for them. They have these really long lifespans. God is very free with them, and we see that with all of this freedom, the early humanity takes it, and they fill the earth with violence as a result of that. When God gives them a free hand, that is the result. And that's one of the big arguments that the Bible makes about the nature of humanity, that we are fundamentally evil, that we take any power that's given us and we use it ultimately for evil. So it's a very depressing picture here, but in the middle of all of this, we see first in chapter 5, in the middle of the genealogy of all places, the first sort of glimmer of hope. We read the genealogy of Adam, and we find out what the legacy of Adam is. It's a legacy of death. Everyone in the genealogy dies, except for one person. It was Enoch, the seventh from Adam. His death is not recorded in this genealogy, and it says that Enoch walked with God. So whatever this phrase means, this is clearly something that's going to be very important in the book of Genesis. And then we get to Noah, and we get our first really elaborated example of what it looks like to walk with God. And we find out that Noah was someone who trusted God. And when God warns him to build the boats to protect him and his family, he trusted God and he did everything exactly as God had instructed him. And so Noah lived a life of faith and the whole world was destroyed. We read that man had destroyed the earth, so God was going to destroy them from the earth. And then after humanity is wiped out, we get the Noah and his family coming out of the ark, and it really seems like creation is being reset. God establishes his covenant with Noah, never again to destroy the earth with a flood. It really seems like here, maybe finally in this family, we're going to finally get this promised descendant who is going to strike the serpent in the head. But unfortunately, that is not what happens, and we can maybe pick up in Genesis chapter 9. Genesis chapter 9 and verse 20. So this is after God establishes his covenant with Noah. This is a covenant which is not based on anything that Noah did. It's simply God providing freely a promise without expecting anything in return, that he is not going to destroy the world again through water. We see God establishes capital punishment for murder, which is in contrast to the way that he treated Cain originally, because God did not sentence Cain to death, even though he had killed his brother. So we saw God being very merciful and permissive before the flood, and we saw what humanity did with that freedom. So now after the flood, there is this greater restriction. Overall, this passage so far has been very hopeful and looks very promising for the future. But then we read in Genesis chapter 9, verse 20, Noah began to be a farmer. And in Hebrew, what it literally says is Noah was a man of the earth, just like the Adamah, just like his father Adam. Noah was a man of the earth. And he planted a vineyard, and he drank wine and was drunk and became uncovered in his tent. Verse 22, Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it both on their shoulders, went backward and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned away and they did not see their father's nakedness. And then there Noah proceeds to pronounce a curse on the descendants of Ham and a blessing on the descendants of Japheth and Shem. So already in this very first family after the flood, we see a theme that comes up multiple times in the book of Genesis, which is the theme of children somehow exploiting their parents. And we see Ham in some way mocking his father or taking advantage of his father as a result of his drunkenness. And so even in this family of the man who God said this is Noah was a just man, perfect in his generations, even this family has some very serious issues, some very serious disunity going on here. And then we can read in chapter 10, and we find out about the descendants of Noah. And basically, I think this chapter is sometimes called the Table of Nations, because we find out the origin stories of all these different nations. So all these nations are coming from Noah and from his descendants, but they're all descendants of this very broken family. And we can read about what they did in Genesis chapter 11. In Genesis chapter 11, we see the first story about what all these great nations are coming together. And it says in Genesis chapter 11, verse 1, the whole earth had one language and one speech. So again, they're all united. This is, in some ways, I think, at least in my circles at the college I go to, a lot of people think if we could just all get rid of all these divisions between peoples, all these different, if we could all just be united together, and maybe if we all just had enough education, if we all just had, if we all could really get to know each other, then finally all the world's problems would be solved. You know, we could all just get along. And eventually we'll get there someday. That's the attitude a lot of people have. But this is very clearly against what the Bible is arguing here. The Bible is arguing that when humanity is all united together, that the result is just they're even better at doing terrible things, just on a larger scale. So in the story of the Tower of Babel, God is going to take a very different approach than he took before the flood. Before the flood, God let humanity have a very free reign. But now God is going to start putting restrictions and bounds on humanity. So that's what we see in this story. Genesis chapter 11 and verse 1. The whole earth had one language and one speech. And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. And they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly." And they had brick for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. And they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. And let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, "Indeed, the people are one, and they have all one language, and this is what they begin to do. And now nothing that they propose will be withheld from them." So God is seeing the thing that they're doing, and you know, building a tower maybe isn't necessarily a bad thing, but God is saying here, nothing that they try to do is going to be impossible for them because they're united, and that's a really bad thing. That's what we've seen so far, that when you're able to get away with anything, that's a really bad situation. So God says, "Come, let us go down and there confuse their languages, that they may not understand one another's speech." And so the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they ceased from building the city. And therefore its name is called Babel, because there the Lord confused the languages of all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth. And this begins a process which is described throughout scriptures, where God raises up nations and tears them down. We read Paul will say he sets their appointed boundaries and the times when they're supposed to live there. And everything is being controlled by God. He raises up leaders and he brings them down. And all of this is part of a process that God uses to restrain the evil that the world is allowed to do. And in the backdrop of all this is where we're going to get the big story. The big story isn't about all of these powerful nations and the rulers that rise up and then are taken down. But the story that's going to be very important is the one that we're going to get to later, which is kind of happens in the background, not very visible. It's not in the forefront. It's not in your face. But it's a story about one man and his family. But anyway, so this story demonstrates something about the character of God that's come up, or something about God that's come up before. I just want to point it out here in verse 7, the Lord is saying, let us go down there and confuse their languages. And he uses a plural word there. And there's been different, he also uses this kind of language in Genesis. And there's been different suggestions about what this means. And some people will argue that it's referring to the Trinity. But one possibility that I think is maybe what is trying to be conveyed here is the idea that God is a king. And that he is speaking to some sort of heavenly court. We see this kind of language later in the Bible, too, where God says, like, for example, who is going to go to Ahab to convince him to go to war? Or when Isaiah sees him and God says, who will I send to Israel? Who is going to go for us? So the Lord, the idea, even if that's not what it's trying to convey here, the idea is that God is a king. He has ministers who do his will. And, you know, he has heavenly ministers who do his will, spiritual beings, but he also has individual people who do his will. And the people who do God's will are part of God's heavenly court. He sends them on missions to go and accomplish things, and they do it. And this heavenly court is more powerful than any of the nations of this world. And this is a court that we're all a part of. We're all a part of God's kingdom. It's a very upside down kind of kingdom compared to the nations of this world. But we're all part of the people who do God's will and accomplish his purpose. It's a great privilege for us. I am reminded of a story that I read once a while ago. This is a story about a missionary, or not a missionary, a believer in China during a time when there was very vigorous suppression, even more than now, of Christianity. And he felt that God was leading him to go and give a Bible to someone, or something like that. And he, for a long time, he didn't act on this, but eventually he did. And he found out when he gave this Bible to this person that this person had been praying for a Bible for a long time, for the same amount of time that that this believer had been felt led to go and do it. So this one guy was praying for a Bible to God. God directed one of his ministers to go and accomplish this task, and he resisted for a while, but eventually he went. And you know, this kind of reminds me also of the story of Gabriel, how as soon as Daniel started praying, God sent Gabriel to go and answer some questions that Daniel had, and Gabriel was delayed for a while because of some things that we maybe don't fully understand, but he eventually got to Daniel. And so we see that God, even though God is all-powerful and he can just act directly, he acts often through all of these ministers, and we are ministers of God. So when God directs us to act, it's really important that we do so, because we don't understand God's plan, but we know that we're a part of it. And in particular, God here is sending his ministers to go and take down these all these powerful nations as if it's nothing. And we'll see that again later on in the book when we start reading about Abram. So continuing on now from the Tower of Babel story, we get this genealogy, and this genealogy starts to focus in on one particular family line. And one of the things that we see in this genealogy is that the lifespans get shorter and shorter and shorter. And so we see God is, again, restricting, putting more restrictions on humanity. So they can't access, I guess, the same level of evil, maybe, that they don't have the same amount of freedom that they had before the flood. And this genealogy continues. It focuses in on one family and on one person, Terah. And in Genesis 11:27, we read, "This is the genealogy of Terah. Terah begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Haran begot Lot. And Haran died before his father Terah in his native land in Ur of the Chaldeans. Then Abram and Nahor took wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah, and the father of Iscah. But Sarai was barren, she had no child. And Terah took Abram, his son, and his grandson Lot, the son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, his son Abram's wife, and they went out with them from Ur of the Chaldeans to go to the lands of Canaan, and they came to Haran and dwelt there. So the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran." And we read about two Harans in this in these few verses. They're not spelled the same way in Hebrew, but they sound similar. And both of them, one of them is a son who died, and the other is a place where Terah died. So we see immediately that the family of Terah has a big death problem, and the name Haran is repeated many times in this short space. He was the son who died. But we're also introduced to Abram for the first time. Abram is listed first among the sons of Terah, even though he was not the firstborn. So we see Abram wouldn't have traditionally had first place in this family, but he's going to be the one who God chooses, and so he is listed first here. God lifts him up from not being on top. Haran was actually the oldest, and he died. So that this is the legacy of Terah. But the story of the genealogy of Terah is mostly not about Haran. It's about Abram. And so we're going to see that th- through Abram, Terah's legacy is actually going to be very different than it would have been otherwise. It would have just been, without God's intervention, this just would have been death, 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 barrenness, and that's it. But in chapter 12, we find God intervening in this story. And God says to Abram, get out of your country and from your family and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. And I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. You shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. So God tells Abram to go to a place, doesn't tell him where. And, you know, God could have revealed everything to Abram from the beginning, but he does not reveal everything to Abram from the beginning. So that we see that he is testing Abram in a sense. He's not showing him everything. He's just showing him the next step, what he's supposed to do. And God makes him a bunch of promises that through Abram would be known as someone who God has blessed, and that through him, everyone in the world would be blessed. And so we see here the next step in God's promise originally made to Eve, that through some of her, through her descendants, there would be some kind of deliverance. And now that theme is repeated here through one of Abram's descendants. So we see that line continuing here. And we read that Abram, in verse 4 of chapter 12, Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. And if you read back in the story of Noah, you'll see a lot of dates marked out in Noah's life. He was such and such years old when this happened. Because these are significant events in Noah's life when he acts in obedience with God. And this is a significant event in Abram's life when he acts in faith and obeys God and leaves the lands of Haran, the lands of death. And he took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered. They take everything that they had acquired in Haran, in the land of death. They take it with them, and they go to the land of Canaan. So Abram's first step here is a step of obedience towards God, and he has this whole journey that's described. But then in verse 10, there is a famine in the land. And so Abram leaves the lands where God told him to go, and he goes to Egypt to dwell there because the famine was severe in the land. And in verse 11, it came to pass when he was close to entering Egypt that he said to Sarai, his wife, indeed, I know that you are a woman of beautiful countenance. Therefore, it will happen when the Egyptians see you that they will say, this is his wife, and they will kill me, but they will let you live. Please say you are my sister, that it may be well for me, with me for your sake, and that I may live because of you. And Abraham came to Egypt, and the Egyptians saw the woman, that she was beautiful. And the princes of Pharaoh also saw her and commended her to Pharaoh, and the woman was taken to Pharaoh's house. He treated Abram well for her sake. He had sheep, oxen, male donkeys, male and female servants, female donkeys, and camels. But the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. And Pharaoh called Abram and said, what is this that you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say to me, she is my sister? I might have taken her as my wife. Now, therefore, here is your wife. Take her and go your way. So Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away with his wife and all that he had. And Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him to the south. And Abram was very rich. And so we could continue reading on. In this story, we see Abram act based on a problem that he had. He didn't have any food, so he moved from the place God told him to be and went down to Egypt. And we see him act in order to protect himself. In a way that kind of puts his wife in a lot of danger. It's not a very not a very nice commentary on the character of Abram that he would kind of put his wife in harm's way to protect himself. But he has all these plans for how he is going to protect himself, provide for himself. But what we see in this chapter or in this story, is that God is much better at protecting and providing for Abraham, for Abram, than he is at protecting and providing for himself. And we see that even the great Egyptian civilization, this great nation, when they did something against Abram, God fought for Abram and protected him and plagued Pharaoh's house, and Abram gives Pharaoh gives Abram back his wife and gives him a bunch of stuff and says, get out of here. This is kind of similar to the story of Abram's descendants later, where they are God plagues Egypt and they are eventually sent out and they leave Egypt with a lot of possessions. And we see now that Abram, as he's going back to the place God told him to be, and the different stops he takes along the way, retraces the stops that he took along the way when he originally went to Canaan. So this is very much seems like this is a story about Abram going back. So Abram's faith journey was not a linear thing where he started out right away with a bunch of faith and he just continued having faith and always acting in obedience to God. We see Abram initially does the right thing. He goes to Canaan, but he has these times of doubt, these times when he tries to rely on himself. And even in this time when he's not relying on God, God is still there for him, and eventually God brings him back, puts him back on the right track, and he goes back, and now he's taking with him all the stuff that he acquired in Egypt, and he's very rich. He has so much more than he originally had when he came out of Haran. So we see that God is providing Abram with all of this stuff, all of these possessions. And in fact, in chapter 13, verse 6, they Abram and Lot have so much stuff that the land was not able to support them so that they could dwell together. Their possessions were so great that they could not dwell together. And there was some conflict between their herdsmen. So in verse 8 of chapter 13, Abram said to Lot, "Please let there be no strife between you and me and between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brothers. Is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me. If you take the left, then I will go to the right. Or if you go to the right, then I will go to the left." And Lot lifted up his eyes and saw all the plains of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt as you go towards Zoar. Then Lot chose for himself all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated from each other. And Abram dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain, and pitched his tent even as far as Sodom. But the men of Sodom were exceedingly wicked, sinful against the Lord. And the Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, "Lift your eyes now and look from the place where you are, north, south, east, and west, for all the land which you see I will give to you and your descendants forever. And I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if a man could count the dust of the earth, then your descendants also could be numbered. Arise, walk through the land, through its length and its width, for I give it to you." And Abraham continued to wander throughout the land. So in this story, we see Abram performing an act of faith. I believe that this is an act of faith. He gives his nephew Lot the first choice of the land. Even though Abram was older and he could have claimed the right to have the first pick, he gives that up. Unlike the previous story, he's not trying to put himself forward. He's not trying to find some way to get himself ahead. He instead allows Lot to have the first choice. And Lot makes his choice, and he chooses a place that looks very good on the surface. He chooses a place that harkens back to the garden of God, where that was well watered with all these rivers, this abundance. And it seems like this is a place where he will be blessed. But we get these little kind of foreshadowings, these little snippets. This was before God destroyed this place. This is the men of this place were exceedingly wicked and sinful. So there's a big contrast between the way the place looks to Lot and the way that God sees this place. And so Lot makes a poor choice, but he chooses it for himself. And then we read that God comes to Abram, and Abram told Lot to lift up his eyes and decide where he wanted to go. Now, God tells Abram, lift up your eyes and look in that direction, that direction, that direction, that direction, all around you. Everything is I'm going to give you, and I'm going to give you descendants like the dust of the earth. And he tells Abram to explore this new land that is one day going to be his. Go wander back and forth through it. And so we see that God honors Abram's faith. Abram gave Lot the first choice, but God is giving Abram the even not just like the first choice, but he's giving him everything. So more than he could have gotten in his own strength if he was just relying on himself. So we see Abram is now again taking a step of faith. But in the next chapter, this is where things really start to get interesting. In chapter 14, and we see the continued progression of Abram's faith. So in chapter 14, we read a story about a bunch of kings. In chapter 14, verse 1, it came to pass in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of nations, that they made war with Bera, king of Sodom, Birsha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, Shemember, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar. All these joined together in the valley of Siddim, that is the Salt Sea. 12 years they served Chedorlaomer, and in the 13th year they rebelled. In the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him came and attacked the Rephaim in Ashtaroth, Karnaim and Zumim in Ham, and Enim and Shava in Kirathaim, and the Horites in their mountains of Seir, as far as El Paran, which is in the wilderness. And they came back and came to En-Mishpat, that is Kadesh, and they attacked all the country of the Amalekites and also the Amorites who dwelt in Hazazon Tamar. And the king of Sodom and the king of Gomorrah, the king of Admah, the king of the Zeboabim, the king of Bela, that is Zoar, went out and joined together in battle in the valley of Siddim against Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, Tidal, king of nations, Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elasar, 4 kings against 5. Now the valley of Siddim was full of tar pits, and the king of Sodom and Gomorrah fled. Some fell there, and the remainder fled to the mountains. So the reason I read that and read all of those names is because clearly this passage is really drawing attention to the fact that there's all these kings. It keeps repeating their names and listing them all out. And there's all these nations involved, all these different peoples, all this. This is a massive conflict, 4 kings against 5. This is a huge struggle of nations, something that you might read about maybe in a history book. This is the kind of thing that a history would be concerned with. These kinds of massive power struggles. And they meet together in a valley that's full of asphalt pits. And I don't know if this is a coincidence. I don't think it is. Back in the Tower of Babel, it also mentions that they had asphalt for mortar. This is the last place that this word asphalt popped up. Is in the story of the Tower of Babel. So, and both of these stories are about God disrupting the plans of these massive nations. And so, maybe that little detail was included there in order to remind us back of the last time when we saw all these nations and how God was able to deal with them. So, there's this massive conflict, but they made one mistake in chapter 14, verse 12. They also took Lot, Abram's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and all his goods, and departed. So they interfered with some of Abram's family. And in verse 13, one who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew, for he dwelt by the terebinth trees of Mamre, the Amorites, the brother of Eshcol, and the brother of Aner, and they were allies with Abram. When Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, he armed his 318 trained servants who were born in his own house, and he went in pursuit as far as Dan. And this is, I mean, it kind of seems hilarious. Abram hears that this massive battle of 4 kings against 5, and he takes his 300 servants and goes chasing them down. He's not even defending himself. He's going after them. So So we see Abram's faith here. And he's not going alone. He's going with Mamre and the Eshcol. He's going with these people, the Abram's neighbors. He's able to convince them to go with him. So clearly, Abram must have some crazy testimony that these people who are living around him are willing to go with him on this insane chase after all these kings. And so they go, and in verse 15, he divided his forces against them by night, and he and his servants attacked them and pursued them, chased after them as far as Hobah, which is north of Damascus. So he brought back all the goods and also brought back his brother Lot and his goods, as well as the women and the people. And the king of Sodom went out to meet him in the valley of Sheba, that is the king's valley, after his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him. And in this king's valley, there's going to be a meeting. Abram is going to meet with two kings. One is the king of Sodom, and the other, in verse 18, is Melchizedek, the king of Salem. His name means king of righteousness, and Salem means peace. So he's king of righteousness, king of peace. Brought out bread and wine. He was the priest of the Most High God. This is the first time this particular title for God appears, the Most High God. And he blessed Abram in verse 19 and said, "Blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hands." And he, Abram, gave him a tithe of all. Now, the king of Sodom said to Abram, "Give me the persons and take the goods for yourself." But Abram said to the king of Sodom, "I have raised my hand to the Lord, the God Most High." So now Abram uses this same title for God, God Most High, the possessor of heaven and earth. He's reflecting Melchizedek's language. "I will take nothing from a thread to a sandal strap, and I will not take anything that is yours, lest you say, I have made Abram rich." So, after returning from this massive conflict, you know, Abram has an opportunity here. Clearly, if he's able to defeat these five kings who apparently have some kind of, maybe empire isn't the right word, but they clearly have some kind of control over this entire area that all the other kings are paying them tribute. Abram just defeated all of them. Abram could become a major, you know, political figure. He could be a big conqueror. He could make a name for himself. He could take all this, the riches of Sodom, which was apparently a very rich, desirable city, and he could go that route. But that's not what God has planned for him. And so he turns down the king of Sodom, and he recognizes something very important, that his riches are not coming from his personal conflicts, but he doesn't want anyone to think that the king of Sodom is the one who made him rich, but he recognizes that all that he has comes from God, and so he has faith in God. And he demonstrates his recognition that his victory and everything that he had came from God by giving a tithe to Melchizedek of everything that it just says a tithe of all. What can we make of this? God has chosen this one person, man, and he's working somehow in his own life. And apparently, this is more important to God than any of the other things that are going around at this time. You know, the book of Genesis could talk about Melchizedek, or it could talk about all these different kings and all these different nations and the things that they did. But that's not what's important to God. The whole main narrative, God's whole plan, his whole the thing that he is doing in the world isn't something massive. It's not about geopolitical power. It's not about great wealth. It's just about this story of this one man who has faith in God. This one man who wasn't anything significant, but God chose him. God made him significant, and God lifted him up from being nothing, and he made him something. And apparently, God is clearly more powerful than all of these nations. All the things that are going on around Abram aren't important. He doesn't even have to worry about them. The only thing he has to worry about is trusting God and acting according to God's plan. And now maybe we, looking back in retrospect, can see a little bit more of God's plan and why he chose Abram. And we can see that this is all leading up to Christ. Abram didn't necessarily see all that, but he trusted God and God worked through him. And in the same way, we can trust God and God can work through us, even if it's not something that the world would look at and see, oh, wow, that's amazing. We are servants of God, and when we have faith in him, God is the source of everything that we could possibly ever need, all riches, all the power of this world, all the glory of this world is nothing compared, all the knowledge of this world, nothing compared to what God has for us, what God provides for us. So we're just like Abram, we're going to have times when we try to rely on ourselves, but God is the one that we can rely on for everything. Let's close in prayer. Lord, I thank you that we can trust in you. And I thank you that you provide us with every good gift. Please help us not to chase after the things, the empty things in this world, the things that are so insignificant, all the power or honor or knowledge or riches. I thank you that what you provide for us is so much better than any of that. I thank you that you give us abundantly all good things to enjoy. And I thank you that you've chosen us as your servants, even though we're imperfect and we're just such imperfect servants. I thank you that we are a part of your kingdom and we can serve you today. And I thank you for your son, the Lord Jesus. In his name, I give you thanks and I ask all these things. Amen.